Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, guys and girls. The program you are about to hear will be both fun and educational, but it is not a substitute for medical advice. Although we are doctors, we are not your doctors.
Hello, and welcome to Travel Medicine. As always, I'm your friendly neighborhood internal medicine doc, Dr. J.
Hello, everybody. This is your amazing pediatric infectious disease doc and researcher, Dr. Santosh.
And we want to greet you a little longer. Say hi a little longer. Have you clued in to this theme song? Longer with Santosh and Dr. Yes, there we go.
Yeah.
Longer with Travel Med.
There you go. Because we do our red features prominently in our logo. For all of you people.
How did I miss that?
Yeah. Oh my God. I'm sorry. I'm a little giddy after that because by far and away, listeners, and if longtime listeners already know this, but for those of you who are new, Dr. Josh is the creative powerhouse of this podcast. And I bow to that. I really do. I appreciate him. Every now and again,
the rhyme is right there.
Yeah. I get a little drop in and it makes me a little bit giddy that like, okay, I still got some juice left. But
so we were talking about some of our favorite commercial jingles and fast foods. And
by the way, I was born in 1980. So we grew up mostly in the 1990s, the part of our childhood that we remember. So that's
the era of the absolute best commercials.
Yes.
Commercial jingle. Like it was the era of the commercial jingle. You don't hear a lot of jingles nowadays.
Yes, that's true.
But it got me thinking about how we could connect food and medicine, and not like in a culinary medicine way, although that is an up and coming field. No, I wanted something that could fit into a podcast episode. Something quick, filling, if not nutritious.
Sure.
Something fast.
Just like you could drive by and grab a quick fact bite.
Yeah.
And then just like you'd be on your way. Like you can, like the rest of your day is going to be fine. Yeah.
Like a run by fruiting.
Says Robin Williams, God rest his soul. Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, yeah, we could do that.
So it's not quite an alternate week, but it's not quite a full history dive. We're just going to give you some little tidbits, and we're going to go into some fast food medicine.
Woo! I'm loving it, Josh.
A phrase? Okay, the guy who wrote the I'm loving it jingle, also the same guy who wrote the Arby's We Have the Meats jingle. One person responsible for both of those jingles. No, it was Pusha T.
Yes.
We have the meats.
The meats. so succinct. I mean, it tells you exactly why you're going to that place and what to expect. It's nothing more, nothing less.
So as we get into our jingles and our products, I want to take you back to the oldest fast food restaurant, the dawn of fast food, the Wild West of medicine and eating technology.
Okay.
Do you know what the very first fast food chain in America was?
So the one that qualifies as fast food is like what we think about today. Go up there, quick order. They wrap, you know, like a short wait, 3-5 minutes. They wrap up your thing, and boom, you're in. Is it a McDonald's?
I'll give you a hint. If you, an Indian man, were to pair up with an Asian and go looking,
oh,
it might take you 2.5 hours and a series of hijinks.
Okay, all right. Would my name in this hijinks-filled adventure be Kumar?
I mean, it might if you want to change your name. I was just racially profiling.
Okay, so you're trying to get me to that ever-so-famous White Castle.
That's right. The very first fast food chain predating McDonald's appeared in 1921, Columbus, Ohio, and then moved quickly to Wichita, Kansas.
Oh, gotcha. Whoa. Okay. So I'm kind of mistaken. For whatever reason, I really thought that fast food would have been established somewhere like East Coast, but it was like in the heart of the United States, huh?
That's right. Beef country. We have the meats. Thank you, Pusha T. So here's the problem, though. Fast food was being invented around this time, but nobody was going to eat it. Because the concern, you know, nowadays restaurants are always rebranding to say they have healthier options. But when fast food began, the public's concern was that it could legitimately kill you.
Oh, well, I mean, is this like a fair thing of like, oh, this food is just being fried up really quick and, you know, thrown into a bag and whatever. And we don't know if it's undercooked, food poisoning, all this kind of a thing like that type of kill you?
Sell them by the sack. No, like straight up, the meat could murder you. We have the meats and they want you dead. Because at this time, one of the top read books of the day was Upton Sinclair's The Jungle.
Ooh, which okay.
Described the meatpacking industry and described it as horrifyingly unsanitary. For those of you who have not had the pleasure of reading The Jungle or a dedicated literature teacher, I'm going to give you just a quick sample. Now, it was a fictional book, but it put such a scare into people that it escalated to the level of the government, who sent in food inspectors and found that a lot of the things described in the book were very true, if not even worse. So, a brief reading. It was only when the whole ham was spoiled that it came into the Department of Elsbieta. Cut up by 2,000 revolutions a minute, mixed with half a ton of other meat, no odor that was ever in a ham could make any difference. There was never attention paid to what was cut up for sausage. It would come all the way from Europe. It had been rejected, was moldy and white. It could be dosed with borax and glycerin, dumped into the hoppers, and made over again for home consumption. There would be meat that had tumbled out on the floor, in the dirt and sawdust where the workers had tramped and spit uncounted billions of germs. There would be meat stored in great piles in rooms, and the water from leaky roofs would drip over it, and rats would race about on it. It was too dark in these storage places to see well, but a man could run his hand over these piles of meat and sweep off handfuls of dried dung. Sounds delicious, right?
Oh, okay. So, horrible preparation, preservatives of, you know, borax is definitely something you should not be eating, and glycerin, and then, you know, floor and sawdust and mouse dung and rat dung. Yo.
So nobody was buying hot dogs or hamburgers because this is what they thought was happening to the meat.
Okay.
They would only buy, you know, essentially organic cuts you could get from the butcher. You had to be able to identify your own meat before you would eat it. This led to more expensive prices of meat. And one of the, and you know, Teddy Roosevelt basically bullied Congress into passing food safety regulations in 1906 based on this book, but people still weren't buying it. So along comes Edgar Waldo Billy Ingram, owner of the White Castle food chain.
That's not his name.
Edgar Waldo Ingram, a.k.a. Billy. Don't ask me how you get there. I don't
know. Yeah, Billy from, there's no William or Will or anything.
Maybe Waldo, Billiam to Waldo.
Hey, I'm Edgar Waldo. You can call me Billy. No, I can't.
Well, owner of White Castle said, listen, we can get ground meat cheap. It's not, now that food regulations have been put in place, because it's the 1920s, we don't have all these things taking place. So how do we convince people eating burgers are safe?
Eat 100 burgers in front of a crowd of wary onlookers.
You're not entirely off, but that's a one-time deal. So instead, Billy resolved to convince a university researcher to put the healthfulness of hamburgers to a test. Now, you may be thinking this sounds a little bit similar to a early 2000s movie called Super Size Me. About McDonald's. But just like with fast food, White Castle did it first in the 1920s.
Okay. All right.
So we have researcher Jesse McClendon, PhD, who had made his name studying things like the composition of hemoglobin, the mechanics of human digestion, the effects of iodine deficiency. He once swallowed an electrical device just to measure the acidity of his own duodenum.
Wow.
So Billy Ingram went to this well-known researcher and said, hey, I want you to design a project to convince people that hamburgers are safe to eat. And more importantly, my hamburgers are safe to eat. So the White Castle Project allowed this biochemist to devise a study that would influence public thought and hamburger sales for years to come. So McClendon knew that they had recently done studies that shown adult dogs fed for a month on only lean meat and nothing else appeared to fare well. Yeah. And that humans on temporary all-meat diets lost calcium and phosphorus, but didn't really develop deficiency diseases like scurvy. So he planned to feed a single subject only White Castle hamburgers, including the bun, onion, and pickles, and water, for 13 weeks.
Oh, okay, so this was exactly like Super Size Me. They went on an experimental hamburger diet.
Yeah. Now, for those of you who haven't had the joy of eating White Castle hamburgers, they're, you know the Simpsons joke, steamed hams?
Yeah, steamed hams, yeah.
That's basically what White Castle burgers are. They're very tiny sliders with a single pickle, a little bit of onions, and the burgers, and they're all steamed to cook. So the bread becomes a little bit soggy and tastes of onions, and it's an acquired taste, which I have yet to acquire.
Okay.
So, enter medical student Bernard Flesch. Flesch.
Yikes. I do not want to. No. You can't make me.
Flesch kept a diary and started out very enthusiastic. Like, this is how he put himself through medical school.
Okay.
He started out very enthusiastic about eating 10 burgers at a sitting, and White Castle sliders are very tiny.
Sure. Okay.
A couple weeks into it, he began losing his enthusiasm. His sister frequently tried to tempt him with fresh vegetables to no avail. He completed the full 13-week study and, importantly, maintained good health throughout the three-month period, was eating 20 to 24 hamburgers a day during the last few weeks. And this research proved that customers could eat nothing but our sandwiches and water, fully develop all their physical and mental faculties.
I don't know. This was a medical student.
This was a medical student in a study by a biochemist commissioned by the owner of a fast food restaurant to prove that people could safely eat nothing but hamburgers for 3 months straight and still not have any outwardly negative effects, meaning he still completed medical school. He completed the full 13-week study. He never willingly ate a burger again, and he died at the age of 54 from heart problems.
What? There it is.
Yeah, but that was in the 1950s. Like, this was in the 1920s.
I think their lifespan was still a little bit better than 54, especially if you were in a higher socioeconomic class. I don't know it for sure.
I just wanted to point out that the very first version of Super Size Me was to convince people, not that burgers were healthy or unhealthy, but they're just like, no, you can eat our burgers and it won't kill you. And in fact, a medical student thrived, or so we say. A medical student lived on this, so, you know, come on over and start eating. And there's a whole bunch of other ways they influenced the fast food industry after that, but it all started with this scientific study.
Wow. Okay. All right, so science for the win, I guess, although after you've related that story to me, I see zero scientific method in that procedure. Just not even a thing. They weren't asking, I guess they were asking a question, but they weren't trying to replicate results. They weren't running a control. This was the least science that's ever
been
science.
The control was everybody not eating burgers for 13 weeks straight. The purpose of this scientific study was essentially, you know, he's eating burgers. Burgers are unsafe. But did you die? I will send the actual study to you. You're right. It's very weak science, but in terms of propaganda and fast food science, it got the job done.
Okay.
So people then began eating more and more burgers. So let's jump ahead to today, where now obesity and food deserts and fast food are all interlinked.
Yes.
And researchers led by Dr. Jason Block at Harvard surveyed people at fast food restaurants across New England. And they talked with 1,800 adults, 1,100 teens, and 330 children at a variety of eateries like McDonald's, Dunkin' Donuts, KFC, Subway, and so on.
Right.
They asked customers to save their receipts when they went, then estimate how many calories were in their meals. Most of the customers, just by virtue of the demographics, ended up being non-white, with 65% of the adults and 57% of the children being obese. And 40% of the survey respondents all reported eating at the same restaurant chain at least once per week.
Wow. Okay. Those are 57% of the school-age children, Josh.
Who responded to the survey.
Well, yeah, but oh, dear. Okay. Yeah.
All right. So here's where you run into the interesting thing. Again, you know, you have all these people who are on the obese side of the BMI, but you also have fast food restaurants saying they have all these healthy options. So how do you reconcile that? If we give the fast food chains the benefit of the doubt and say a healthy option is being offered, why might people still be gaining weight on these fast food diets? After all, we proved they're healthy back in the 1920s with the White Castle study.
We did not prove they were healthy. You fixed, stop that right now.
Fixed forever.
Yeah. Okay. So if you say, okay, yes, I'm offering you a healthy alternative, something, you know, based on, you know, it might be vague requirements for what we call healthy in terms of caloric intake and balance of carbohydrates, fats, proteins, and nutrients and all this kind of a thing. But I'm almost certain that in that case, people would order the healthy alternative plus the unhealthy alternative, or just way too much of the healthy alternative. And just probably like purely calorically, they, you know, still be taking in too much of unhealthy
right
food.
On both counts. The average meal, which includes a sandwich, defining a burger as a sandwich as well, the average
Sorry. Go ahead.
The average meal includes the sandwich, the fries or side, and a drink. So an average meal is 836 calories for adults, 756 calories for teens, 733 for kids. So if we look at, say, a Happy Meal. Now, if I asked you how many calories you thought, what's your go-to fast food item?
So I, being a proud Indian vegetarian, am a patron? No, a customer, a frequent customer, although way too frequent, of Taco Bell here in the United States, because you cannot be a proud Indian American without having consumed several.
What's your item, Santosh?
Mexican pizzas. That's the one.
Okay.
It's neither Mexican nor a pizza.
How many calories do you think is in a Taco Bell Mexican pizza? Don't look it up. Just give me your best guess.
I'm not looking it up. Okay. So it's two thin wafers. We got cheese and some sauce on there. We're going to pour on some hot sauce and stuff. There are black beans and things like that. I imagine, because it's pretty small, that I'm hitting 500 calories.
Okay, you are in the minority because that's actually very close. A Mexican pizza is 540 calories. Now, when they interviewed all these people, I told you, 836 calories in an adult meal.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I'm a 5'8" person. I am obese.
No,
it
doesn't matter. Well, 836.
No, not that. That's a third of my day's calories. That's it.
So the average meal is 836 calories for adults. Two thirds of people underestimated how many calories they were eating because something was on a value menu or had a side salad. One quarter underestimated the calories they were eating by at least 500 calories.
Whoa. Okay.
On average, people misjudge the amount in their food by about 200 calories, and the larger the meal, the larger the misjudgment, with Subway being the most insidious, with adolescent estimates averaging around 500 calories, which is on the low side.
Okay.
And adults and adolescents eating at Subway thought that the calories were 20 to 25% lower than those at McDonald's, meaning you get an 800-calorie sandwich at Subway, or an 800-calorie sandwich at McDonald's, and the people eating at Subway actually just think they're taking in less calories.
Wow. Okay, so they just completely, like, bamboozled.
Yeah, so even if you're eating the healthy options, which is something they did restrict in the White Castle study, the caloric intake, so they were keeping the calories in mind, and making sure you could have... Oh, not so unscientific now, is it?
No, I can't. Just because they actually controlled one parameter. Stop it.
So one of the things that makes fast food unhealthy is the high amounts of calorie-dense meals that you underestimate how many calories you're actually taking in.
Right. So it's... You know, you feel like you're eating one meal, as a for instance, but in fact, you're taking in enough calories that would account for two or even maybe all three meals in one sitting.
With a standard diet being about 2,000 calories a day, at least for our diabetic patients, is a hospital setting. So if you add up the calories you're eating in the day minus the calories you're expending, one meal at McDonald's could be half your calories for the day. And that's not going to be something that necessarily fills you up for a prolonged time.
Right. And that's the weird part about it is a lot of people, and this has to do with actually like sugar and insulin regulation and this kind of a thing and what these foods actually do. But essentially you can feel kind of like semi-full eating a meal at McDonald's for a little bit, but very strangely, you get hungry again much quicker than you would, you know, if you had had like a big proper meal that was less caloric.
So we've now learned so far, you can safely survive on nothing but fast food as long as you're counting the calories. But there's other ways that fast food is affecting our overall health beyond what it may be doing to our weight and metabolism. And that is, its consumption may be driving drug-resistant infections and superbugs.
Gotcha. Oh, my God. Yeah,
I felt like you'd have a bigger reaction to that, but maybe I was wrong. No, okay.
I'm not going to lie. It makes me sad because, as you know, infectious disease and everything, I'm a very big proponent of antibiotic stewardship and making sure that we don't overuse these kind of things. And this is one of the greatest sources of antibiotic misuse and overuse that thwarts all of our efforts. So meaning that I can do everything that I can to talk to my fellow doctors and patients and everything else to like control your antibiotic use, and they could still be suffering from multi-drug resistant bacteria because of what's going on in our agriculture industry.
Meaning it doesn't matter if your doctor isn't prescribing you antibiotics you don't need, if you're getting neomycin from your nuggies and penicillin from your,
hamburgers?
From your pollo.
There you go. Oh, you're trying to alliterate.
So while progress has been made to reduce antibiotics in food, most of that progress has occurred in chicken. And with a few exceptions, most companies really haven't made much progress in reducing the use of antibiotics in their pork and beef supplies. In fact, only two companies currently serve antibiotic-free pork, beef, and poultry. You want to take a guess what those two fast food chains are?
Fast food chains, antibiotic-free meat, poultry. I'm trying to think of like a hippy dippy fast food chain, and I can't think of any. I'll throw out a couple. I'll go with two of the big ones: McDonald's and Burger King.
No, they're both around B or C because they have a plan. They don't have a timeline.
Oh, gotcha. No, I don't know who.
Chipotle and Panera.
Chipotle. Chipotle. If there was one of those where you like, if you would phrase this as Santhosh, I bet you didn't know that there was this one company that refuses to use antibiotics in their meats. But you know what? Maybe they should. Stop giving.
So
all their patients' diarrhea. Their patrons, sorry.
So scorecards get done every couple years to assess the rate of compliance and the decrease in use of antibiotics in food. So Chipotle and Panera have consistently scored A grades for their policies with respect to antibiotic use in their meat. Subway adopted a policy that does address antibiotic use in its beef as well as its poultry, but its implementation is on a very long timeline, so it's only at a B+. KFC has a B-, which is an improvement compared to its previous year's F, because it's
okay.
It is transitioning its entire product line to being raised without antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
White Castle continues to get an F. They don't care. They're just like, look, we peaked in the 20s. Our meat's safe to eat. We don't care if it has antibiotics in it or not. Now, there isn't any evidence that antibiotic-free meat is safer for consumers than antibiotic containing meat. And antibiotics are an important tool for treating and preventing illness in livestock. But how did we get to the point where antibiotics got in your tacos and your nuggets and your burgers to begin with?
They're fed to our animals. I believe.
Yes, but why?
I believe that it actually, and this is actually a true phenomenon, that it's not really to protect them from getting sick. It's actually to help them get fatter and bigger, the animals.
That was incidental, but true.
Oh, okay.
So in 1910, so remember, the Upton Sinclair published The Jungle in 1906. Lots of people stopped eating meat.
Okay.
As such, healthy meat, not ground meat, went up very, very high. And right around that time, we start getting into World War One, which means what little amount of good meat there is, in theory, is going to the war effort. So millions of Americans in 1910 joined a national meat boycott to protest prices. And urban protests against the cost.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Cost of meat resulted in picket lines, smashed butcher shop windows, and even some riots, after which the USDA was encouraged to fund research aimed at keeping food supplies, especially meat, on pace with demand. So regulate it and produce it. So at first, animal scientists focused on research that would help farmers improve nutrition for single stomach animals. Okay. Ruminants are a little bit different. Like, cows have four stomachs. In case you didn't know that, now you do.
Yeah.
So they're like, all right, well, how do we improve nutrition in single stomach animals? And at first it was just, you know, a vanity project. We would like this to happen, but, you know, it's not a huge crisis. And then along comes the Second World War with Pearl Harbor on one hand, Nazis on the other. All the supplies of livestock feed, such as fish meal and cod liver oil, dried up, either because we couldn't import them or, again, going to the war effort.
Wow.
So okay. Farmers were spending more to feed livestock, but their efforts were producing scrawny animals at higher prices.
Right.
Which means the White House and Pentagon, not to mention farmers, were, you know, bitching at scientists, find us an animal protein substitute. So they started trying to make a super soldier serum for animals. Some conducted feeding trials using different combinations of vitamins, minerals, amino acids. Others switched over to feeding sweet potatoes and soybeans, of which the U.S. was the world's second largest producer.
Yeah.
In 1948, Merck announced the discovery of vitamin B12, which they had isolated in animal liver.
Right.
This made headlines worldwide for a couple reasons. It would cure pernicious anemia, which at the time was a global and fatal disease, but a literal ton of liver could only give you 20 milligrams of B12.
That's not enough.
No. Yeah. So, and this was, you know, part of all these studies that science was doing about increasing animal production. This was one of the ones that happened to come along. So Merck was looking for other drug developments. They're like, oh, what's this? Now, 2 years later, you go to Cyanamid's Lederle Laboratory.
Uh-huh.
And that is the chain that linked nutrition and antibiotics. They were investigating a poultry mystery when chickens rooted through bacteria-rich manure, their own or other animals.
Right.
They laid more eggs and had lower mortality rates and fewer illnesses.
Okay. Yeah, what you would expect, you know, kind of protecting them from acute illness and this kind of a thing. You know, basically avoiding illness from the natural pathogens that are in the soil and, you know, dirt and stuff around them.
So the team turned its microscopes on the organisms in the poop that the chickens were rooting through and found that one of them produced a substance that strongly resembled B12. In conjunction with the Merck study, people started to say, hey, wait a minute, is B12 what distinguishes animal proteins from plant proteins? So to test that, they started feeding animals with B12 created by residues left over from the manufacture of an antibiotic oreomycin.
Okay, not got it.
Oreo like gold, Oris, no. Not Oreo like sandwich cookie.
Yeah, yeah. A-U-R-E-O, right. Oreomycin. Uh-huh.
All right, so you still with me? We found B12 could cure pernicious anemia. Fun, but not practical. You only get a little bit out of the liver. Then chickens digging around in poop seem to do better, and the organisms are producing, again, something that looks like B12. So let's take this leftover soup from antibiotics we're manufacturing and use that soup to create B12. We can repurpose some of those bacteria.
Okay.
And feed it to our animals just to see if that is what's doing it. Is that if that's what's helping them lay more eggs, have better health. The animals that ate the antibiotic-based B12 samples grew 50% faster than those fed B12 from other sources.
Wow. Okay.
And the second they found that, they later discovered, in addition to B12, it wasn't just B12. It was B12 plus a little bit of antibiotic, a microdose of oreomycin had worked its way into this B12 formulary. So you have a combination B12 antibiotic.
Okay. Gotcha.
This is what was causing the animals to grow faster. So farmers immediately abandoned expensive animal proteins like cod liver oil and the imports to just give B12 with microdoses of antibiotics. Livestock were reaching market weight, production costs dropped, prices for pork and poultry dropped. All of these become political and economic decisions that spun out of a fun scientific decision.
Oh, dear. I see why we are where we are today, and it makes me sad.
So since 1946, farms have been using antibiotics included in the livestock feed. Now, this was officially licensed in the 50s, and the boundaries between promoting growth, treating sick animals, and preventing animals from developing disease soon blurred, because if you can feed an animal and it'll grow faster, fatter, and thicker, you get more to market, E-I-E-I-O. Uh-huh. And
I don't remember that verse in old. Yeah.
And then industry scientists started developing even more non-human antibiotics as a source of revenue beyond. So like, okay, well, we can treat human diseases, but also, are there any small antibiotics that we can put in that maybe don't treat a disease, but if you mix it with a little bit of B12 can increase how fast animals grow? So by the mid-50s, you have streptomycin sprays and solutions to prevent bacterial plant infections. Tetracycline preservatives delayed spoilage in U.S. fish and shellfish.
Okay.
It allows food to be preserved longer. It allows animals to grow faster and fatter, and really helps relieve a lot of the food pressures in the post-war period. For most industries, you want to hazard a guess as to what industry's inclusion of antibiotics actually slowed things down?
Slowed things down. The bacteria industry?
Yeah. What industry uses a lot of bacteria, Santosh?
Oh, are you to actually make, so fermented foods. So cheese makers, blessed are the cheese makers, beer and alcohol folks who are using bacteria as well as yeast and fungi in order to ferment their spirits.
Yeah,
is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. Okay. So following a bunch of complaints by dairies about antibiotics being fed to cows was disrupting cheese production because the antibiotics would kill off the bacteria in the milk that you would need to ferment and produce cheese. So studies were done and consumers were shocked to learn that up to 10% of U.S. milk samples were contaminated with penicillin during the mid-1950s.
Wow. Oh, dear. Okay.
So antibiotics started becoming culturally associated with dangerous chemicals suspected of poisoning Americans or causing cancer.
Okay.
So under intense pressure, the FDA first introduced a monitoring program for penicillin residues in milk in 1960. So we started scanning to see what kind of antibiotics were making it into our food.
Yeah. By the way, I do want everyone to take the realization here for a second of what kind of political will and effort it takes to monitor our food supply and make sure that what we're getting is safe. And much more importantly, that the industry has to be transparent, that what they say is in our food is actually in our food. This does not happen like automatically. It takes a ton of effort and will.
Just as a fun contrast, this is happening at the same time as our previous episode on fluoride being introduced into the water supply, but we're also screening our milk for penicillin.
It's good. We're, you know, as the country is kind of growing up out of like post-war, we're developing, you know, our public health infrastructure.
In 1969, a committee of government experts concluded that the use of antibiotics in animals contributed to antibiotic resistance in humans. That's when we first made the link. Before then, everyone's like, great, we'll feed animals antibiotics and vitamins. They'll grow faster.
Yeah.
They'll be fatter. We keep things down. And then in the late 60s, early 70s, we're like, oh, you know what? Turns out when you give all these antibiotics, you create drug resistance, and bacteria who can transmit horizontally, meaning within the same generation, not just to their children, but also to their coworkers and friends, you can transmit this resistance to infections into the same humans who are eating these products.
Yeah. And just to let everybody know, we were thinking of, you know, antibiotic resistance all the way back by, you know, like 1947. So Fleming won his Nobel Prize 1945 for, you know, creating the first generation of the antibiotics that we think of today. And just 2 years later, there was a full recognition and an understanding of like, hey, we got to be careful with this stuff. And we took our eye off the ball for just a little bit and in the wrong industry, because we weren't thinking of humans. We were thinking of animals and food supply rather than health. And this kind of slipped away from us. But I'm glad the recognition was made.
So at that point in 69, we can send a man to the moon. Maybe we should stop putting antibiotics into our farm animals before we send them there. And so the committee recommended, and I want you to listen for the most important word in here and see if you can tell me what it is.
Okay.
All antibiotics important in human medicine should be banned as growth promoters in farming. Did you catch the qualifier?
Tell me that again.
All antibiotics which are important in human medicine should be banned as growth promoters.
Oh, damn it. It's just so basically they're taking the caveat that, okay, all antibiotics that are important for human medicine, there's a lot of other antibiotics out there.
And how do you know what's important to human medicine when we're still discovering new bacteria that can cause infections every day?
Yeah. And new antibiotics. We're still discovering new antibiotics.
So the earliest changes were the early 70s saw penicillin and tetracyclines banned as growth promoters. But there's still a lot of antibiotics being used in food service, although apparently not at Chipotle and Panera. So...
Which I know I'm vilifying Chipotle. I'm really sorry. They made the headlines many, many times for, you know, gastroenteritis outbreaks. But I think overall they've fix their, you know,
but they're not contributing to the buildup of drug resistance and superbugs. They keep their diarrhea local and homegrown.
Very fair. I'll take it.
So now that you understand how your food was studied, determined to be safe, drugged, undrugged, let's move on to close out the episode with something non-drug related, another medical technique that made the jump to food service.
Okay.
If you had to look at the wide range of medical technology available to us today, which one do you suppose you could repurpose for food and cooking?
Medical technology.
Yes.
To do food. I would go for probably in the pharmaceutical industry, you know, because good cooking and making a, you know, a fun.
Santosh, I just spent 15 minutes telling you how we're trying to get pharmaceuticals out of the food industry.
Well, I understand that. But biochemistry is the same backbone you use to make a good medication or a good dish. So, you know, I would have thought something like that. You know, it's a, you know, the way that you combine molecules together, you know, for instance, to make aspirin, is like, the same thing.
It's like you don't even listen to our own show.
Okay. All right, smart guy. What do you want to repurpose?
Ultrasound.
Ultrasound.
Yeah.
You want to, just ultrasound imaging?
Yeah, ultrasound, sound waves.
Wait. Do you want to like ultrasound a steak, like see what's inside of the steak, like using an ultrasound imaging kind of thing, or do you want to like crank up the power and like buzz the
it's steak so funny that you mention ultrasounding a steak, because one of the earliest ways that ultrasound was determined to be a medical technology instead of just a shipbuilding technology was when an OB-GYN doc brought a tender, juicy steak and a couple ovarian cysts to an industrial shipyard and asked to ultrasound to see if he could tell the difference in the biomass, if he could tell the difference between what was what using nothing but sound waves, and he could. So ultrasound and steak have a long history, and we'll get to that. And that's for when we explore more radiology. But no, let's talk about some of the ways ultrasound is used in the food industry today. It gives you the possibility to better emulsify sauces, to tenderize meat, to age wine. So let's talk about wine first. You can I love this. You can sonicate an acidic wine or a sharp spirit to smooth its taste, or flavor it by infusing with oak chips. Ultrasound is a non-thermal processing method which has significant effects on the product. So you can extract flavors faster. You can mature wines faster, much faster than you could just waiting around. And that's because the sound waves force the destruction or cavitation of tiny bubbles invisible to the naked eye. It bursts them, and that allows foods to better mix and age, or it allows you to better infuse one kind of food into another, mixing them.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. So I have used sonication in some of the research that I've done. Very specifically, I used it to break apart basically suspended cells inside of media, using these high frequency sound waves in order to, you know, bust these cells open, in order to later fractionate them, so that I could examine proteins in the suspension. So I'm very familiar with this, and it is a fantastic technology to actually, like, you know, break apart, surfaces that would normally be really, really too hard to break up. And that also means that they'll emulsify better. They'll actually like mix in the case of the food. In my case, it was to actually separate components out.
All right. So there's aging wine. Back to our steaks. you can tenderize your meat and marinate it with the meat buzzer. Great name.
The meat buzzer?
So why, you sonic...
Why do the non-pharmaceutical and non-medical industries take something like a sonicator and then give it such a cool name? Like, we never get those.
Right? You don't see a lot of OB guys being, just bring me the kid buzzer machine.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. So for those of you who do have little handheld sonicators, you can place your meat in a marinade, set a medium amplitude, and use a larger horn. You move the ultrasound horn or paddle slowly over the surface of the steak, which softens the filament, opens the pores so the marinade can penetrate deeper and instantaneously, as opposed to having to wait for 2 to 3 hours. Like, this is what molecular gastronomy is all about.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, the whole practice of marinade, you know, takes a long time and you need everything to kind of soak in. But yeah, if you can do this where you can just basically, you know, high frequency waves, so that all the, you know, the muscle strands essentially that kind of open up a little bit, you could perform the same marinade that would take you like an overnight in, I'm guessing, like a seconds, minutes, something like that.
Also, those of you who have ketchup, fruit juices, or mayonnaise in your fridge and cupboard, those are all sonicated to improve the emulsion and make them smoother. Your ice cream is made using crystallization from a enhancement from ultrasound. So crystallization resistant nucleation has been initiated in sugars like fructose and sorbitol that are important in the formulation of candy, confetti, cream, and chocolate.
Okay.
Now, most microorganisms show a higher sensitivity to ultrasound at temperatures over 50 degrees. So combining ultrasound with a heat treatment is effective at a low temperature, improves the quality of products at pasteurization, which means you don't have to use as much energy to clear bacteria out of your food. It can store longer without having to require as many preservatives, chemicals, or, here's the big one, antibiotics.
Oh, very nice.
And it's not just in the U.S. In China, ultrasound is used to improve the quality of infant meat puree. Now, that's not a puree of infants. It's baby food. It's baby food with meat in it. But I like that they use the phrase infant puree.
Infant meat puree. Yeah, okay. infant meat puree is people.
I mean, the U.S. is the second biggest producer of soy in the world, so.
Oh, God. let's not. You're going to get us, like, destroyed by the soy farmers of America or whatever the hell it is. Like, this underground shadow organization that we just besmirched.
Just. Ultrasound is being used throughout the food industry on products you don't even realize. It's healthier and safer and in some ways even lower cost because we get to use fewer preservatives, we get better qualities of food, and all this is something that started to most people's minds as a medical technology. Now, we will go into the history of ultrasound in a future episode, but I find its uses in food fascinating. The last thing that we're going to talk about in fast food medicine before we close this episode out is the final category of not how our food is medicated, not how our medical technologies are used in cooking, but actual medical food. Yes, that is a real topic, a real condition. It is defined as a food formulated specifically to be given under the supervision of a physician or for specific management of a disease or condition. And that's all defined in the Orphan Drug Act, which requires, now, you know, for most supplements, you have to have safety and efficacy studies, even if they're loose, but medical foods are not regulated under the drug provisions of the Federal Food and Drug Act, but under the food ones. Do you know who is one of the biggest users of a medical food or diet?
Medical food or diet? Well, we use lots of prescribed medical foods and diets in our premature babies. We've got those for, you know, because you sometimes have to give like elemental formulas and this kind of a thing.
Earth, fire, wind.
No. It elemental meaning it's broken down into its component parts.
And then the Fire Nation attacked.
No.
And it changed everything.
No. An elemental formula is one that breaks down. Instead of having like large, you know, agglomerates of like fats and proteins and stuff like you have in milk, you break it down into individual amino acids. So that it can be better absorbed by little babies whose stomachs aren't
so
ready for it.
So would you say you're a milk bender?
It has every weird connotation when you call me a milk bender. Oh, God.
So the medical food or diet, you're right that it's primarily children. And one of the biggest ones I was looking at is the use of the ketogenic diet for intractable epilepsy in children. That's right. Kids out there are going keto for all the right doctor recommended reasons.
Yeah, this is... it is very specifically used. We actually, there was a period in time when ketogenic diets became, you know, more widespread in terms of, you know, helping out children, and whether it was like reducing weight. There is a ketogenic diet that's used for epilepsy, but now we're finding out kind of more focused uses for this, because when it's used for the right indication, it's fantastic.
So there you have it. We have gone from burgers being deemed dangerous and unhealthy to the point that a fast food chain commissioned a study on their safety to babies eating Atkins.
Yeah.
Literally use a modified Atkins diet.
It's a modified Atkins, right? Yeah. And yeah, we just want to get them to the point where you shift the pH of their body environment to, you know, change the brain chemistry to avoid.
So they can be cut.
No. So they don't seize. Stop it.
The day?
Oh,
so they don't seize the day?
Close these this episode.
Powerlifting babies.
do the thing. Do the spin the globe and the wash
so,
your hands.
So lift a little longer. Eat your food a little longer.
This is so weird.
Make sure that it fights off all those super bugs.
This is like a therapeutic thing.
I'm sorry, would you prefer a different jingle to play us out, Santosh? Do 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 do. This episode is produced by me and Dr. Santosh, and we are fresh and full of life. If you want to read more, check the journal, check the articles in the score. Which we also call our show notes, hey! Fresh goes better. All right, I'm going to give this up. If you'd like, as always, we'd love to hear your comments, questions, and feedback. That is everything that we know about fast food medicine or medicine in the fast food industry. If you'd like to support us spiritually, emotionally, or financially, links to do this are in the show notes, along with links for further reading. This show is produced by me with a lot of help from Dr. Santosh and friends. Our theme music is composed by Rachel Leisure. And until next time, as always, keep a song in your heart, soap on your hands, a shot in your arm, a burger in your gut, if you are so inclined.
Less fast food, more fresh vegetables and grains. Look,
on your globe, and if you have the meats, or you're loving it, or you just want to cut down on antibiotics in your diet, perhaps sign up for a cooking class, and when you've picked a place to do it, go off, get out in the world, and happy travels.
Bye, everybody.
We have the beats.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.